At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. This week, I'm joined by Dr. Bryony Bamford. Bryony is the founder of the London Centre of Eating Disorders and Body Image. And this week, we discuss the importance of an MDT team in supporting people with eating disorders and body image concerns. And we also discuss further how eating disorders and body image can be entwined, and also how body image cannot be an element of somebody's eating disorder. We talk about body dysmorphia and also the information that is needed by clinicians to understand that not everybody will have a diagnosable eating disorder, but their condition is worthy of just as much support. Hello.
Hi, Hannah.
How are you?
I'm okay. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you perfectly.
Oh, good. I last minute had a headphone disaster, so I've had to borrow my husband's headphones, which I'm not very used nice. To at all, and I hope I can black them out. And then I had a Chrome disaster. But
oh God, yeah, I should put like a disclosure on the email to everyone, like beware of Chrome, because I swear, like the past 5 podcasts I've recorded have been, everyone's just had issues with Chrome.
Yeah, well, it updates all the time, doesn't it?
Yes,
and so I'm sure it would need an update. Just before. It's always when you don't want to update something that it needs an update, isn't it? Always, yeah. Every time.
Literally having this conversation at work the other day, someone was like, is everyone else's Chrome updating all the time? And I was like, yes.
Constantly.
And then it says like, Chrome's going to update in 40 minutes. And I'm like, yeah, cool, whatever, 40 minutes. And then I'm on a call and then it updates and I'm just like, okay, everything's
fine. It's so annoying. It's so annoying. And I put it off and I put it off and until something like this. And it's like, yeah. You can't put it off anymore.
Yeah.
we need to have the latest update.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I'm so excited to chat to you. I actually went to the Body Dysmorphic Disorder Conference on Saturday. So this feels really nicely timed with all the learning that I had on Saturday and then speaking to you about body image today.
Lovely, lovely.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
How was it? Was it good?
It was really good. It was a very emotional day. I think I said to you before, like I struggle with body dysmorphia myself. So I went for Full of Beans, but there was a lot of people talking about their lived experience. And it was a really interesting dynamic. Actually, I was speaking to a friend and saying how it's so interesting from a research perspective, because I've done research. It's so interesting to like hear about the research that people are doing on body image and body dysmorphia and stuff like that. But then when they're talking about like the participants and the research that they're doing, you realize you're a subject. And then it's like, yeah, that was quite a hard thing. But it's strange because like I've done research on eating disorders before and I've never been affected about like learning about anorexia or learning about excessive exercise, that sort of thing. But the body dysmorphia felt like, oh, like I'm now a subject and you're trying to work me out, sort of thing.
Yeah. Interesting. I wonder what the difference is there.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the difference for me is that my eating disorder, I think body dysmorphia was like the foundation, the start.
Yes.
Then
which it isn't for everybody, but of course, if it is, then that's probably a much more powerful impact in thinking about those difficulties.
Absolutely. Which we will totally come on to today to talk about body image and eating disorders and all that amazing content that we're going to talk about.
Lovely.
So I guess to start with, do you want to introduce yourself, introduce your clinic,
and
tell us a little bit about the work that you do?
My name is Bryony Bamford. I'm by training a clinical psychologist. So I trained as a clinical psychologist nearly 20 years ago now. And now work, I'm clinical director and founder, I guess, of the London Centre for Eating Disorders and Body Image. And we founded 10 years ago this year. So it's been a while. It's a milestone, I know. The intention, I guess, is very much to be a specialist eating disorder and body image clinic. So we started off primarily as a group of psychologists who specialised in eating disorders, who practice in both an evidence-based way, but also holistic person-centred way. And those are two things that I'm so passionate about. And often I think that they are regarded as slightly incompatible, but they're so compatible. You know, you can be an evidence-based practitioner, but also a person-centred holistic practitioner. And when I founded it, I can talk to you a bit more about a lot of the frustrations that I was having as a clinician before founding TLC, but it was very much based on the desire to be a clinic that offered specialist care in a slightly more flexible way, perhaps, than some of the than NHS clinics, but also genuinely a specialist treatment clinic. So I think there were a lot of clinics at the time that would see eating disorders as part of, as one presentation of many, but there were far fewer, if any, kind of specialist therapy-led eating disorder clinics. And from there, we've grown in size, but we've also grown in terms of the types of treatments that we offer. We can be a lot more holistic now because we have a much bigger MDT. So we now comprise not only psychologists, psychotherapists, family therapists, occupational therapists, dietitians, nutritionists, and very recently added psychiatry as well. Wow. So it really is kind of a very, very highly specialist clinic with the intention of being able to meet all clients where they're at, but offer them what they need rather than being only able to offer one type of treatment, if you like.
And is that, so just, I guess, for people that maybe aren't quite aware of the terminology, so when you're talking about like holistic person-centered, yes, is that what you mean by that? You've got so many different disciplines and different types of specialists that you're able to sort of meet that person with what they need rather than, yes, you know, here's this one evidence-based treatment that not work. You can do several evidence-based treatments and kind of have a think what's going to work for someone.
I mean, I think for me it means two things, really. I think it means being able to be flexible as a clinician. So, you know, we have our evidence-based models that we know are really effective and work really well. But of course, they're never going to work for everybody. Mm. There's never going to be such a thing as one model that works for all people with an eating disorder. That takes no account of individual difference or, in a psychologist, we work in a very formulation-based way. So we understand the kind of the whys and the details rather than just in a diagnostic-led way. So it means as a clinician really being able to think about what treatment model is going to work or what integration of treatment models is going to work best. But it also means, I think, recognizing that for some people psychology will be what is needed. For some people psychology will be what is needed at a certain point in their treatment journey but not at a different point. For some people psychology isn't quite what's needed and they might need, you know, something. They might need family therapy, or they might need psychotherapy, or they might need occupational therapy, or just dietetics, and not have that need or that ability in that moment to go into the more underlying psychological aspects of their difficulties. So I think it's both flexibility as a treating clinician, but it's also the ability to bring in different clinicians or different kind of disciplines as is needed.
Yeah. And I think that's the fantastic thing about sort of an MDT team and having that holistic approach is that you can bring in different people at different stages.
Yeah.
Because I think often, you know, people are given one form of treatment that's supposedly going to mean that they're then recovered after that.
Yes.
But, you know, things change as you go along and you might need Absolutely. Different people to work with you along
yeah.
the journey.
Yeah. And you often do. You know, I think that's the reality is it's not occasionally you might need to bring in different people. I think with eating disorders, often you need to bring in different people. So, I mean, there's so many advantages, I think, of having a multidisciplinary team. One of those advantages is that you can speak to your team and get support from your team. And as a clinician, that's incredibly helpful. You know, what do you think? What are you kind of, what might your guidance or your perspective be? And I think that's incredibly helpful as a clinician. But I also think, you know, as a client, you might start off with psychology and then you might realize that actually, you know, just a little bit of specialist dietetic input would be really, really helpful at this point. That's something I could really, really use. And later on, you might think, you know what, I feel like I've really got on top of this, but life is feeling difficult to catch up with. I could really do with some OT input. Or you might think, you know what, I feel like I'm getting on top of this, but I'm really struggling with my mood. I'd just like to speak to someone about what medication might offer or whether it might be, you know, it might be kind of beneficial for me to consider medication. You might get to the end of your kind of therapy journey and you might think, I'm ready to end therapy, but I'm also incredibly anxious about ending therapy because it feels like a huge, you know, a huge jump from kind of regular therapy to contemplating ending. So we've recently brought in recovery counselling, which is a way of just very ad hoc having somebody. But if you're having a really difficult week, if you're struggling, you know, you've got someone to turn to. And that's not really something you can do so much in psychological therapy, which tends to be, you know, the model of psychological therapy tends to be weekly or fortnightly, but certainly sort of regular therapy sessions. And you need that, you need that regularity to keep the momentum going and to keep the kind of change going. But once you've made those changes and it's more about maintaining those changes, knowing that actually you can dip in and out of support with someone that's known to you can be really beneficial. So that's another example of where kind of working within a team and having that ability to refer on or think about why not just meet with a dietitian and see if it would be useful or meet with family therapy. So your support system around you can think about whether they might need some extra education or some extra support is just so beneficial, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point, what you were saying there about, I think a lot of people, you know, the thought of going from intensive therapy every week or every 2 weeks to then having no support whatsoever.
Yeah, can be terrifying.
I think a lot of people would then almost want to keep the eating disorder behaviours to be like, oh, no, I'm not recovered because I don't want to also now lose. You kind of transfer from the support of the eating disorder to the support of the therapist or whoever you're working with and then kind of have nothing, feel like you have nothing. But also what I was just thinking about there when you were talking about working in MDT, when I worked in eating disorders, something I definitely noticed was, I mean, obviously they didn't have the qualification, but the fantastic thing about, like, you know, having an MDT of psychiatrists, psychologists, dietitians, that sort of thing, they all start to learn off each other. And I remember like speaking to the OT and she'd be like, you know, I'm not a dietitian, but I've worked with a dietitian for 10 years or so. So I can support my patients now with like different eating patterns and stuff like that. And obviously I still would refer them on to the dietitian if required, but it just means that they've got that extra level of insight rather than, you know, just the training that they've had.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes there is just, you know, there's just a very kind of specialist, I'm struggling to think of an example, but there's a really specialist kind of presentation that you just want to run past the dietitian. And you may not be able to do that if you're working kind of in isolation or outside of an MDT. And, you know, we have regular MDT catch-ups, complex case discussions where we can think about, you know, really outside of the just that support session that, that each client has, we can really think as a team about, you know, is this, are we really offering best practice? Is there anything different that we could do? Have you got any thoughts, anything that you think might be helpful here? So I think it's really, really useful, both from a client perspective and also from a clinician perspective, yeah, as you say.
I imagine for clinicians as well, like the, it's funny, I was speaking to, when I was at the Body Dysmorphia conference the other day, I was speaking to Dr. Rob Wilson, and he was asking me like how I was finding the day. And I said, you know, it's absolutely brilliant. It's just a very emotional day because everybody's talking about body image, and that's something so prominent for me right now. And I said, you know, it can be a really isolating experience to struggle with an eating disorder and body image, because at the end of the day, you can, it's all in your head, and you can't, like, I can try and vocalize to you as much as possible, but I don't think there's any way to get across like how an eating disorder makes you feel. And he actually said how he had also really felt.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Value from the day, because, you know, in his normal practice, he is a therapist and he's working with people one-on-one. Can't exactly go home whilst he sat around the table at dinner and say, you know, I had this client today and this happened and it really affected me. But when you've got the MDT team, you do have that space to talk about that and to talk things through. And, you know, if you've got concerns about how a patient is, you can talk to somebody. And obviously, like when you're working on your own, you have supervision. But I think there's just that extra level of like feeling like a team rather than just feeling like you're holding someone on their own.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important. And I think, you know, something else that I'm really, have really become, I think, much more passionate about than I probably was 10 years ago, but is kind of team well-being. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially that's a big part of my role now, is kind of looking after the team and making sure that the team feel that they are supported and they are also developing and learning. And I think that supervision, you know, supervision is vital, but something that I personally feel is really important is that supervision is something that's accessed regularly, but also something that's available kind of PRN, if you like, you know, ad hoc, that actually it's there when you need it as a clinician, because the model of supervision for a lot of people, even, you know, even within certain teams, is you'll have your fortnightly supervision or your monthly supervision, and it's kind of scheduled in. But actually, sometimes you need supervision when you've just seen a client and you're thinking, actually, I really need to think that through, or I'm suddenly aware that the client is feeling quite stuck and I want to think about this with someone, or actually I'm really concerned about this client because it feels like risk is changing. And that's when you need that support and that supervision. And I think that if you look at a lot of specialist eating disorder teams, a lot of teams, especially across the NHS, I think staff burnout is incredibly high now. And how can you support your clients, your patients, kind of as well as you possibly could if you are also burning out? It's just, it makes no sense to me. So actually, kind of that ad hoc supervision model on top of regular supervision is something that I've really become quite passionate about, and I do feel is hugely important. And that's, you know, that's what you can do within a good functioning MDT.
Yeah. I think it's so important, the element of staff wellbeing, because I think, you know, any sort of healthcare profession, you are in within your job, your role is to look after people and to put patients before yourself in terms of, you know, when you're supporting them and stuff, it's the focus is on them rather than the focus being on you.
Of course.
I think regardless of your own, like even if you have a fantastic relationship with your body and food and you always have, I think when it becomes 9 till 5 and the only conversations you're having are around food and body, I know when I was working in eating disorders, like it just become very draining, because you don't, even if you're having a conversation that's not necessarily related to food and body, when you're with a client, it's still very heavy. And, you know, you're holding them for that 45 minutes, 60 minutes, however long you're with somebody. But if you've got several people that you're seeing a day, like it, it's a very kind of difficult topic to talk about, because we all have to exist in body. We all have to eat. So I think you do then start to maybe question your own beliefs around food and body, and just having somewhere to, you know, take all those thoughts and process them so that then they don't become an issue for you. I think is really important to be able to have that space to talk about how you feel about working with the patient as well.
And even outside of those areas, you know, clinicians are human beings and they will go through human life experiences, and sometimes those are hard. And I think, for example, that was something I became really conscious of during COVID, when we were all suddenly thrown into this very peculiar kind of life. And, it, you know, that was hard for the vast majority of people. And being a therapist, I think, had its own challenges during that time, when suddenly you were working from home. You know, you're used to kind of seeing people, having people in front of you, doing face-to-face work. Most therapists really, really enjoy and value face-to-face work. And you're suddenly sort of crammed in your front room trying to kind of best support people that are going through difficult things that are actually the same things that you were going through. So, you know, that's that support and that kind of that contact, I think, with your team can be hugely crucial in having that kind of positive knock-on impact on being able to best support your clients, which is what we all want to do at the end of the day.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because like before COVID, I mean, it might have been a thing, but I don't think many people saw therapists online. I think therapy was seen as something definitely
it's much rarer.
You go to a clinic, you sit in a room together, you know, you sit in the comfy chair that sort of swallows you up and that sort of thing. It wasn't necessarily done online. But I think I, you know, I personally, my therapist is online, and for me, it's really beneficial because it means that I can be in a safe space in my own home. I don't have to travel. You know, I can do it straight after work and I don't have to have that. But equally, I do appreciate, you know, the kind of impact of having that in-person contact as well. So it's difficult, it's a balance, but I can imagine during COVID particularly people coming saying, you know, I feel isolated, I'm not seeing friends and family, it's really difficult, and you're sat there like, same. But this is what I'm going through too.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I mean, to your point about kind of the benefits of remote working, I think there's pros and cons, absolutely. I mean, we did offer remote sessions before COVID, but they were sort of exceptional, if you like. They were much rarer, and we would have, you know, our protocols around remote working were really different at that point. We would always ask for a face-to-face assessment. We wouldn't take on high-risk clients remotely. They would have to be in person. So, you know, it was, there was a lot more, if you like, kind of anxiety around it, or just sort of it was much more boundaried. I think there was much tighter protocols around it, but then we were forced to do it, and then we realized that actually it does work, and that was wonderful in many, many ways, because that means, you know, specialist eating disorder treatment is something that is really, really, really rare in most, definitely most parts of the world, in most parts of the country as well, to access private specialist, you know, highly specialist eating disorder treatment is something, it's becoming slightly easier to access now, but it was, you know, really quite a rare thing to have specialist ED clinics. They didn't exist outside of London until much more recently. And so being able to kind of offer that to people that otherwise wouldn't be able to access specialist treatment was a really, really nice feeling, you know, and it still is a really nice feeling that people can now access specialist treatment where they wouldn't have been able to for geographical reasons before. But equally, you know, it doesn't always work. And I think there is really something to be said for the kind of the relationship that you can form face to face. So it's nice now to be able to have the choice, and for clients to have the choice of which is easier for them and which is preferable to them.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's all about balance of thinking about what's going to be the most preferable or the most productive for both the therapist and for the client as well in terms of their recovery. And I want to come on to talking a bit about body image and eating disorders and kind of, I guess, the work that you do with your clients. And mm-hmm. when we spoke before, I was very happy to hear, you know, you work with a range of different clients, so you don't have to specifically be diagnosed with an eating disorder to get support.
Absolutely. So yeah,
I wondered if you could maybe tell us a little bit more about kind of how you work with different clients and how you would support somebody, you know, with those body image issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things in what you've just said. I think the first is that you don't have to be diagnosed with an eating disorder in order to access treatment. And to me, that's incredibly important because there's a lot of people out there that are really, really struggling that don't meet our kind of our diagnostic criteria, if you like, for a specific eating disorder. And one of the things that I genuinely feel does a lot of harm in this field is being told that you're not able to access treatment. You know, and there's lots of reasons why people are given that they're not able to access treatment. A really common one being that they're not seen as unwell enough, often due to kind of frequency of certain behaviors criteria or weight criteria. And I think those messages are so not only unhelpful, but incredibly harmful. And I see why services sometimes have to have them, because, you know, if we look at the NHS, for example, it's so severely under-resourced that it would just be absolutely overwhelmed if it opened up to kind of, it opened itself up to not needing criteria for kind of intake. But equally, in our service, that was one of the things that I really, really felt very strongly about, was that there shouldn't be criteria. If someone wanted help, if someone wanted treatment, that they should have every right to be able to access treatment. So we don't, I mean, yes, of course, we see, you know, we see the kind of recognized diagnosable eating disorders, but we also see, you know, a lot of people that would be, I guess, what we would refer to as kind of subclinical eating disorders. So they have disordered eating, but don't necessarily meet criteria for an eating disorder. Emotional eating might be an example of someone who doesn't meet diagnostic criteria, but is still really struggling with their relationship with food. And then body image as well. And I think when I set up the clinic, I think I was hugely aware that there were really quite a high number of people, and I don't think we have the research to fully understand how many people would fall into this kind of category, but people who really, really had a very problematic relationship with their body, whether that's body dysmorphic disorder or whether that's, again, a non-diagnosable but a really, really distressing relationship with their body that really impacts their day-to-day functioning and their emotional the emotional world, if you like. And that you know, BDD is an example of something that tends to often sit within the OCD sort of category of diagnoses. So often people who are OCD specialists will also work with BDD, and that's, you know, that's right, because there are crossovers and there are similarities. But BDD is something that also kind of can sit very easily within the eating disorder kind of field, I think. Historically, I guess, and still now, there is an idea that you can't be diagnosed with BDD if you also meet diagnostic criteria for an eating disorder.
Really?
Yes. So, do you know, I can't remember if it says this within the DSM. I expect it does. I think it does. But essentially, if your eating disorder diagnosis, if you like, trumps your kind of BDD diagnosis.
Top trumps.
Right. so you'd get that diagnosis, and your body dysmorphia would be seen as an aspect of, or a kind of symptom of, if you like, your eating disorder. But the only reason for that, really, and actually it was Rob Wilson and I who had a discussion, and he originally kind of discussed this with me, because I was like, well, why is that? That makes little sense to me. But the reason for that really is that because eating disorders can present with such high risk, that what you don't want is someone starting kind of classic BDD treatment when there's a really high risk situation there because of eating disorder behaviors, if that makes sense. So that's the only real reason why, kind of theoretically, you shouldn't really be diagnosed with both presentations.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. And you'll hear me wandering around saying, well, I mean, I guess that is a stark example of why, you know, just kind of logistically saying that you shouldn't have two diagnoses, or the both diagnoses doesn't work, because personally, like I was said at the start, I feel like my body dysmorphia is the stronger element, and the anorexia comes in and it comes out and plays a role, of course, but the body dysmorphia has been there, you know, throughout the whole thing. So I guess, you know, there's an example of where that wouldn't work. But I also think, and I think I've heard this quite a lot, like sometimes with anorexia and with body dysmorphia, the kind of energy restriction that you see in anorexia could be a cause of the distortion. So I guess, is that another reason in terms of you don't want to give somebody that diagnosis in case... they then actually, they don't have body dysmorphia. It's just that they're seeing the distortions because of the low energy.
Yeah, it can do. And certainly we know that, you know, we talk about starvation syndrome. So kind of one of the impacts of have had.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
I think kind of severe energy restriction, if you like, is that it can and does generally distort your perception of your body, but also change your kind of your emotions towards. And your kind of thoughts towards your body. But I think it's a really interesting point, because I think, you know, sort of diagnosis issues aside, I think as clinicians, we do recognize that there are people who struggle with an eating disorder for whom body image is a really, really central part of what kind of triggered the development of, but also what maintains the eating disorder. And there is definitely a subset of people that I think we recognize, okay, well, just changing the eating disorder behaviors isn't going to somehow miraculously change your relationship with your body and start kind of helping you move towards a place of perceiving your body quite differently. But it's a subset, you know, there are equally people who struggle with eating disorders who it's really not about their body image at all. You know, that had very, very little, if anything, to do with onset or with the maintenance of their eating disorder. So that's an example of where, you know, differences in kind of, you know, what could be seen as the same diagnosis, but actually is really, really quite different if you dig into the detail of that diagnosis, needs to be thought about in a way that kind of one model of treatment suits everybody just isn't going to cut it there. Yeah. You will obviously need to be doing, you know, yes, a lot of sort of similar work, but also you know some quite different work, and you'll need to be doing a lot more body image work, you know, really quite targeted, focused body image work with someone who would fall into that category of potentially having BDD alongside, or certainly having an eating disorder whose roots are sort of far more ingrained in body image difficulties than someone that doesn't. And equally, I think, you know, I think there was a period of time in the past that if you were someone with an eating disorder that said that you didn't struggle with body image, you almost weren't believed. Yes. You know, it was almost like, well, of course you are, you have an eating disorder. Yeah. And I think, again, that's another example of how in the past, certainly, and you know, and I'm sure still now with people that don't fully kind of get eating disorders, that kind of researchers or clinicians will sort of twist things slightly to fit with their understanding. Well, this is an eating disorder, so you must have body image difficulties.
Yeah.
So I mean, to go back, we've sort of tangented, but to go back to your original question, which is around work, you know, how do you work with body image, I guess, or I was saying, you know, it felt really important to me that we weren't just an eating disorder clinic, that we also saw people mm-hmm. who had, who struggled with their relationship with their bodies and struggled with body image, because to me, kind of the field of eating disorders and the field of body image are so intertwined. And we have to have, as eating disorder clinicians, we have to have, you know, really specialist knowledge and skills in working with body image. So of course you can apply that to BDD and to other kind of body image difficulties yeah. as well. But people don't often, you know, I think certainly outside of the field of eating disorders, I think a lot of clinicians are quite anxious about working with mm-hmm. body image, or quite avoidant of working with body image. And to your point, again, I don't fully know whether that's because they don't feel that they have the skills, or whether potentially, you know, as you said, we all have a relationship with our own bodies. Is it too triggering? Is it too difficult? Is it too, you know, but certainly we see a lot of people who've gone through goodness knows what kind of treatment before they eventually end up with kind of the specialist treatment that they need. But even people that have gone through eating disorder treatment who just didn't work on body image, or didn't talk to their therapist about body image. And I think that avoidance is a problem, because I think it's, you know, it's something that really needs to be focused on in therapy for those people whom it's a difficulty for.
Yeah. Sometimes, and I've heard this quite a lot from clinicians that work in eating disorders, I think that eating disorder clients are seen as quite a difficult patient group, because the kind of process is very slow. And then it's going to sound really bad, but, you know, probably not the most grateful clients to work with in the short term, because ultimately you're asking them to do something, whether that's to stop exercising, to start eating more, to start eating more regularly, to stop, you know, with their compensatory behaviors, you're asking them to do something that feels like their only way to survive or to be safe. And I think, and because there's not really that like gratefulness, and sometimes I think because of just the way that an eating disorder is, you can sometimes come across quite rude. I know that I personally in my recovery have like said to my therapist, I think what you're talking is a load of shit, and, you know, gone on. And then afterwards I'm like, oh my God, I was just so rude. I think that's possibly an element of why people don't necessarily want to work with eating disorder clients. But I think with that, because it is such a difficult sort of thing to do and requires a lot of resilience, actually the reward when a patient then does start to recover and to get better, I can imagine is kind of so rewarding. And I just wanted to go back to something that you were just saying, and then I have a question that I've been asking like everyone, because I'm just trying to see what everyone's opinion is. So first I'm going to just cycle back a little bit, but you said about, like, you said that when somebody is you know, does have a low energy intake, their body image and their perspective of themselves is distorted. Like, do we know the science behind why that is? Because I think I just now I'm like, oh yeah, totally, that makes sense. But actually when you said it, I was like, but why does it make sense that you would appear larger? Like, why? So I feel like if somebody that without an eating disorder lost a lot of weight, they would be able to see that they had lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, I think the answer to that is quite complex, in that I don't think there is a simple kind of answer to that. And we don't have a huge number of studies that look at that, because of course what you can't do now, you could do kind of, you know, decades ago, but what you can't do now is sort of starve people and test out what happens.
That is very true. Yeah.
So we sort of have to use, you know, as clinicians, we still talk about the Keys study, which is kind of decades old now. But we know that there are some, they're very few and far between, but there are some studies that look at sort of people who, for example, go off kind of mountaineering or do sort of extreme sports, if you like, whose energy intake becomes kind of reduced from what it was. And we know that they report different relationships with their body. In terms of the science, I think, I think there's different aspects that contribute to that. I think that, you know, your brain becomes affected, doesn't it? It becomes impaired, that actually your brain needs a certain amount of energy to function healthily and to function flexibly. And so just the impairment of your brain functioning leads to certain differences, one of which is your kind of view of your body. I think your mood becomes really affected by, you know, people report much higher levels of kind of low mood, irritability, etc., when their energy intake is impaired. And of course, what we know is that when you're feeling kind of irritable, when you're feeling low in mood, that you start to feel worse about most aspects of yourself. And so, you know, one of the ways in which that's potentially going to affect you is that you start to feel worse about your body. So I think there's lots of different sort of factors that feed in to that, if you like.
Yeah. And there was me just expecting, you know, a simple, you know, this is what happens.
It's only right.
We'd all be a lot richer if that was the case. Hey, I just think from like a evolutionary perspective, like it just doesn't seem logical, because, you know, for me personally, if I'm thinking about like evolution, if you have lost a lot of weight, then you would think that your brain would be like, okay, you really are struggling right now, you need to get some food. So the fact that it would make you think that you look larger, it's almost like a coping mechanism so that you can deal with the fact that you've lost weight, you know, if you're out there in the desert and there's no food or whatever. But then equally, it's like, you know, you need a sign that you need to get some food.
But I also think that part of this picture is the kind of anxiety and preoccupation towards your body, not just the perceptual difference. That actually, if you think about kind of the reasons why, you know, historically, if we go back to kind of hunter-gatherer times, why someone would be in an energy deficit, it was because there would be a famine. And you are, you know, one of the reasons why preoccupation with thoughts about food happens during starvation syndrome is that it's kind of functional to think constantly about food, because that's your body's message that, hey, wait a minute, you need to be focusing all of your attention on food. And I think a similar thing can happen with body, that actually you become very anxious about your body and very, very preoccupied with your body. And it's that anxiety and that preoccupation that often fuels a lot of the perceptual distortion.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And maybe in a weird kind of way, that, like, you know, the obsession and the thoughts around your body is your brain's way of kind of telling you that it needs to change. I think maybe, you know, eating disorders are not an evolutionary advantage. The complexities of how they affect your brain are probably not just, you know, to allow you to survive.
Certainly not. But also, you know, let's remember that these are, you know, these are known as kind of, what eating disorders are known as egosyntonic disorders, right? So they're functional. And that's one of the reasons, to your point about why do a lot of clinicians kind of regard eating disorders as notoriously difficult to treat. And I think there's a few reasons why that is. But one of those kind of really significant reasons is that they're associated with really high levels of ambivalence. And that's because they work for a certain amount of time, certainly not forever, as we well know. They kind of perpetuate those difficulties and exacerbate those difficulties. But at the beginning, you know, no one really chooses to have an eating disorder. No one wakes up one day and says, you know what, I think it would be really fun, let's try anorexia. You know, actually, they're trying to meet a need that isn't being met somewhere. They're trying to meet, you know, achieve a function that isn't being met in other ways. And so one of the reasons why body image often becomes worse kind of once someone has an eating disorder is also because it's kind of, in a non-conscious way, it's the way of somebody keeping something that's incredibly hard to do. You know, gosh, how punishing is it to have an eating disorder, but that kind of works for them on a psychological level. So there's that as well. I think that often the body image sort of becomes part of what they need almost to keep up the behaviors that they're using. And equally, I say that whilst, you know, one of the things I said right at the beginning, which I feel so strongly about, is that everyone is different. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't talk about eating disorders as a kind of, this is true for everybody. And as I said, you know, for some people, body image just won't be part of their disorder at all. It won't be part of the picture or their presentation at all. But for a lot of people, they will say, you know, yeah, I've always had sort of underlying kind of body image distress or body image difficulties, but it feels, you know, like it's really taken a life of its own now. And I think there, again, it's multifaceted, the ways in which that is kind of exacerbated through the through having an eating disorder.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, obviously this is just on a personal perspective, but I've really been thinking about it lately whilst I'm in recovery and weight restoring. For me, this relapse recently felt like it started because I was, you know, had so much hatred towards my body. And that was so strong that it felt like the only way to sort of navigate this is to change the way that I look. And so when I was at my lowest weight, the body dysmorphia actually felt pretty maintained, because whilst I still was never satisfied with the way that I looked, I felt like I looked better than I did, you know, when I felt like I needed to make the change. And so I think that's why recently the body dysmorphia is becoming so loud again, because my body's changing again. So I can completely see why people would keep resorting to the eating disorder as a way to get away from the body image concerns, because it did kind of quiet down a little bit.
Yeah.
The thing that you then have to think is, you know, the eating disorder itself, it didn't actually make life easier, because then, yes, I maybe didn't have as strong body image concerns, but I also had zero energy. I couldn't see my friends. Like, I couldn't do anything. So the actual kind of not having body dysmorphia or the eating disorder is the preferable thing. But it,
and the thing with, of course, not being able to see your friends, not having energy to keep up with life, is you start to hate yourself more, because you know, you're not really enjoying your life. Your life isn't giving you the positive kind of reward that it should be giving you. So it sort of feeds back into that. But I think it's also worth really acknowledging that it's kind of an obvious quick solution, isn't it? If you're hating yourself or you're hating your body, that kind of, okay, well, I'll just eat differently, I'll just change my body, feels like a much quicker and a much easier solution than actually addressing the reasons why you hate your body or you hate yourself, which is always going to take longer. Of course, in the long run, it's going to be much more fruitful and much more rewarding, because wouldn't it be so much nicer to not have that body hatred, to not have that self-hatred, rather than to have to maintain an eating disorder to kind of quieten those thoughts down. But it's not easy. And I think that that's why a lot of people kind of, you know, maintain that ambivalence, that they recognize, gosh, this work that I need to do to have a better relationship with myself is tough and it's long and it's really hard work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's very difficult as well when we live in the society that we do, in that, you know, a lot of people, if they are not feeling confident in their body or if they are struggling, you know, going on a diet is seen as the thing to do. And you know,
it's culturally reinforced everywhere, isn't it? Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I hate that, you know, it's awful, because you can't really get away from it. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, just absolutely dread summer or dread January, because they just know they're going to be exposed to so many more messages about kind of idealized bodies and diets and et cetera, and all those kind of triggering things that are really, really hard for a lot of people to tolerate when they're in recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing that I wanted to ask, which is my, I don't think it's controversial, I think it's just something that I'm exploring with people. So I don't like labels. I don't like the diagnostic labels. And I think that it would be more beneficial for people in recovery if, rather than being diagnosed very specifically with anorexia or bulimia, it was more of a broad diagnosis such as an eating disorder. And then that would mean that somebody could kind of get support for their specific behaviors, because for me, I never felt like I, when people said anorexia, I was like, that just doesn't fit with me. Like, it, the the kind of behaviors that I was displaying. And that's taken me years to actually come to the point where I'm like, no, it doesn't work for me. And I've had to deal with that to then be able to deal with whatever is going on. I was just wanting to ask your perspective of, I know that we have to have diagnostic labels for treatments and things like that, but I think even that sometimes can be limiting, because if there's one evidence-based treatment for bulimia, let's say, if that doesn't work for you, it makes it very difficult to then have other options.
I would say in general, I completely agree with you. The reasons really why we have diagnostic criteria are, I think they're threefold. I think they're partly for insurance purposes, especially in countries like America, but also in the UK, you have to have a diagnosis in order to be eligible for kind of insurance funded treatment. So a lot of diagnoses are given for that reason. They're there for research that, we need research into treatments for eating disorders. And arguably, it is easier to get research grants for and to study treatments for kind of slightly narrower presentations of disordered eating. But I also think that, and this is probably far more of a controversial thing to say, but I think that historically, mental health and specifically the field of eating disorders was quite ego-led, that I think that there was far more of a sense of, I want to be the one to develop a treatment for such and such disorder. And people thought much more rigidly in the past, I think, about, it was much more of a kind of medically focused field, that the people kind of driving the treatments forward were often medics who were much more used to using diagnostic terms and diagnostic criteria. In reality, as a clinician, I think that people kind of change between diagnoses all the time, and B, I think you don't place so much importance on those diagnoses. So if I'm seeing someone, I'll do an assessment, and if they want a diagnosis, I might talk to them about what diagnostic criteria they might meet at that time. More often than not, I'm saying in the past, you probably would have met criteria for such and such. Now you probably would meet criteria for such and such, but it's really common to kind of move between different diagnostic criteria. But it will be the formulation and it will be the understanding, the individual understanding of an eating disorder that will inform what I think might be most helpful in terms of treatment. So as a clinician, it doesn't hold that much meaning for me, if I'm honest. It's just a sort of shortcut way, and as a team, again, often, we'll be thinking as a team, well, sort of, this is the presentation, is it that diagnosis or is it that diagnosis? And it doesn't really matter, because it's not going to vastly change the treatment that you're offering or the recommendations that you're making. It's more that, well, do we need to give a diagnosis because insurance wants it or because the client wants it sometimes? And then as I said, you'll talk to them with flexibility about the fact that actually it could be this or it could be that, and it might be different things at different times. So personally, I would come from more of a psychological perspective, where actually I don't think it's hugely important, and I do think that there would be value in having more flexibility. And we're sort of moving there, right? Like, if you look at DSM-5 compared to DSM-4, there's a bit more flexibility. Finally, they recognize that actually there shouldn't necessarily be a kind of weight criteria for anorexia, that you can be an anorexic in anybody at all. But it's slow to catch up, and there's still a lot of kind of changes that could be made.
Change is change, and I think there's, whilst maybe the DSM-5 doesn't categorically reflect it, I think there's more and more conversation around the fact of these things, like anorexia can occur at any size and different things like that. So if we're having the conversations and then that's being built into practice, I think that is a really great step forward.
It's a small step, but it's a step, at least.
Small step, but a small step forward is better than a massive step back.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, well, Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Where can people go to find out more about you and also the London Centre for Eating Disorders and Body Image?
I guess I'd probably refer people to our website, mm-hmm. which is www.thelondoncentre.co.uk.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, you can recover from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. It's honestly, I don't know where the time has gone. It's
just I know it's flown, hasn't it? It really has.
But it's been absolutely lovely to speak to you.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure for me as well, and hopefully interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so.
Fab.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.